You're listening to EPN, the e-podcast network.
Welcome to Enterprise Radio, the signature show of EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network, your channel for exclusive interviews with entrepreneurs, small business owners, and some of the world's top executives who share business strategies and insights that can all help you build your business, leading to your business success. And now, broadcasting from anywhere between Brazil, South America to Los Angeles, California, it is your host, Eric Dye.
This is Eric Dye, and once again, welcome to Enterprise Radio, a part of EPN. In the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Today we are speaking with Mr. Kevin Kozlowski, President and CEO of Oval Brand Fire Products. Mr. Kozlowski, welcome to Enterprise Radio.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. This is great.
You bet, and it certainly is our pleasure to have you today with us. So for starters, explain how you conceptualize the Oval Brand Fire Extinguisher.
Well, it's a bit of a long story, and I'll try to keep it as brief as possible. I started out early on when I invented the fire extinguisher. I originally recognized a problem. And what it was that you can't fit a fully recessed flush fire extinguisher cabinet into a standard depth wall. And when I say standard depth wall, that's a wall that's framed with a metal stud that's 3 5/8 inches deep, with 5/8 gypsum board on it. It's really the main way that walls and interior partitions and buildings are constructed. Probably 90% plus of all walls are framed that way in commercial construction. And where I started seeing the problem was going back in my career over 20 years of working for some of the largest general contractors in the country. On blueprints, you would repeatedly see a note on the drawing that would say flush cabinet. And this is the architect does the drawings, has a note with a little arrow on it to the location for the fire extinguisher cabinet, and it would say flush cabinet. But almost every project I was on, the walls were framed at a standard depth, and it physically is impossible. You know, currently with a round fire extinguisher, whether it's a 5-pound or a 10-pound fire extinguisher, which are the common sizes used in commercial construction, you presently can't make that assembly fit. So to make a round extinguisher fit, you either have to make the walls deeper, you have to go to a 6-inch metal stud or deeper, or if you're going to live with the standard wall, you have to accept that you're going to have a semi-recessed cabinet. It's going to be sticking out of the wall anywhere from 1.5 to 4 inches. So after project after project, seeing this mistake on the blueprints over and over, and then between my field team, my superintendents, and my foreman and myself, we'd have to go to the architects, explain to them that, hey, there's a mistake on the blueprint, which there always are, and they're never going to be perfect. And but we'd go to the architect and say, what do you want us to do? Do you want to make the walls deeper, or do you want to go to a semi-recessed cabinet? And the answer was about 50-50. Sometimes we're tearing walls down that were already built. Other times they would go to the semi-recessed cabinet, but when they did, they always had a bad taste in their mouth because, you know, the architects take a lot of pride in what they do, and they do a great job. And, you know, a semi-recessed cabinet is viewed by designers as kind of a blight. It's they want everything smooth and flush and sleek, and also when they stick out of the wall, they get beat up a lot. You go into a hotel, a corridor in a hotel is a great example. And if they have semi-recessed cabinets, you'll see where they're all dented and banged up from the luggage carts. Or in healthcare facilities, if they're semi-recessed, the gurneys whack them and dent them and damage them. Sometimes they have to fix them. And so when I kept seeing this problem happening, I was thinking about what's involved in making a flush cabinet fit. And what the answer was there's a critical dimension. And to fit a fire-rated cabinet, which is about 15% of the cabinets are fire-rated, which makes them a little thicker around the edges and the sidewalls. Assuming the worst-case scenario, fitting a fire-rated cabinet into a standard wall, the only dimension you have left, the critical dimension, is that you've got 3 inches to work with in depth, front to back, if you want that door to shut. So knowing the critical dimension, I started asking myself, okay, how do we make a 10-pound fire extinguisher in a 3-inch deep assembly. And it was a really tough engineering problem. It probably took about, on and off, working on the weekends and just, noodling around, probably about 3 years of trying to figure out how can we manufacture this and get it down to a price point that was reasonable enough where the market would accept it. I've bought millions of dollars of construction materials over my career, and I knew that we were going to be a premium price, but at the same time, I knew that it was a little psychology. But having asked other architects and other people in my business, different price points, everybody kind of came back to, if it's under $300, the market can accept it. And so it took a while to get the manufacturing technique down to where I was comfortable we could manufacture it at a price to where once the markups are applied across the between ourselves and the distributors, that we could still get it to market at a list price at $300 or less. The engineering was a challenge because round cylinders are a great shape for a pressure vessel because when they're pressurized, they want to be round. And the forces are all held in tension and evenly distributed. Once you make it not round, it wants to be round. And, our vessels, to pass underwriters' laboratories, we have to pass a test at 1,560 pounds of pressure. And it's a tremendous amount of force. And putting that in perspective, on our top and bottom caps on our vessel, there's 45,000 pounds of force trying to rip those caps off. And on the flat surface on our extinguishers, our extinguishers, our 10-pounders are roughly, one model is 3.5 inches deep by 8 inches wide. The other one is 3 inches deep by 10 inches wide. But on that flat face on the extinguishers, there's 225,000 pounds of force pushing outward in both directions. And the challenge is how do you make a pressure vessel that can manage those forces and not move, not distort and twist and pass all these rigorous tests that we have to pass with, the powder's still got to flow right and it still has to perform right and fill and discharge. And there's a lot of things in this UL test protocol that we had to pass. And so we had to invent a new way to manufacture pressure vessels. Early on, before I decided that, hey, we're going to do this, we're going to start a company and we're going to be the seventh fire extinguisher manufacturer in North America. Before we started, I reached out to a couple of the major manufacturers in our industry just to see if they wanted to license my technology. We were patent pending at the time. We didn't have a patent yet. They probably thought I was a crackpot, being honest. Here I'm this little guy saying, I figured out how to make a non-round pressure vessel and I want to make fire extinguishers. And I've got a prototype, which worked, but I approached a couple of them and said, do you want to work together? And I had a few of them sign my NDA. And without sharing any secret sauce at the time, I had photos of my prototype and the pressure tests, but the head of one of the largest brands in the world, the head of engineering for that brand, said it can't be done, can't be manufactured. And I knew it could be manufactured, and the truth is we're shipping them today. I think it's a good example of something that I'm sure somebody else has said it too, but sometimes you're limited by what you know, not by what you don't know. And that engineer, he was limited by the toolkit that he was working with his whole life. He was building round cylinders out of deep-drawn steel shells. And, if you're making vessels that way, you will never figure out how to make a vessel the way we made it. And with that technology, you cannot make a non-round pressure vessel. But we invented a new technique, a new method. It was novel enough that the U.S. Patent Office gave us a utility patent on any non-round fire extinguisher that has, if it has any internal reinforcement, we have the IP on that. We've got a utility patent on that. And we've got a few design patents on top of our utility patent. And we also have a patent for our hook as well. So we saw that there was a few other problems with fire extinguishers besides this fitting in the cabinet issue. One is they fall off hooks a lot, especially in retail stores, land on people's toes, and there's a lot of $5,000 and $10,000 settlement checks in retail. I was determined that, hey, I've solved one problem. Can we figure out a better hook, a better mounting system? And we did, and we received a patent on that as well. When you bump our extinguishers with a shopping cart, they don't fall off. They move. They swivel around a little, we call it our button hook. But when you grab the extinguisher, it still pulls right off, just as easy as the others. But ours don't fall nearly as easily. We hope to really reduce a lot of injuries, in, especially in public spaces, because it happens a lot. I like to go on Twitter about once a week, and I search for fire extinguisher foot or fire extinguisher toe and do a live search, and it's amazing how many people every week are writing in complaining about their injuries. So I'm laughing. It's sad, but it's also funny that the incident, if it's hitting Twitter that much, there's got to be 500 to 1,000 times more incidences than what people are posting on Twitter about it. We also solved another problem, and this gets back to starting oval, that once I solved this flush cabinet problem, you know, how do we make a 3-inch deep fire extinguisher? I wasn't certain that the market was big enough to justify bringing the product to market at that time. So, you know, the market, we estimate that in the year 2020, there will be about 20 million 5 and 10 pound ABC fire extinguishers made in North America. And the challenge is we just want to be a little piece of it. We're a niche product. We know we're not every other extinguisher. But just for this cabinet issue alone, I wasn't sure, because there's, you know, we had to raise a lot of money and spend a lot of time and effort just to get to the point where we're at today. You know, we've been shipping product for 12 weeks. It's you know, it's mid-March of 2017 right now. We started shipping at the end of December of 2016. But it took, we were at UL for 2 years in testing. And I started full-time working on this a year before that. So it took a good 3 years just to get to market. And, so I was doubting before I started that, is this product big? Is the opportunity big enough to justify doing this? And one day I had a light bulb moment, a little gestalt, where I'm walking through Sam's Club, and I'm not afraid to name this place. And I realized that all the fire extinguishers in the store, almost all of them are violating the Americans with Disabilities Act with the way they're installed. Because what the ADA says, and it's also the International Fire Code says the same thing, and the local accessibility codes under, there's an ANSI standard that's in all the local building codes. So it's not just federal ADA. It's in all these different building codes. What it says is that the bottom edge of something is higher than 27 inches. It's not allowed to stick out more than 4 inches. If you can walk by it and bump into it, and it's, again, if that bottom's higher than 27 inches, it can't stick out more than 4 inches. And if it does, it's breaking the law. And I realize all the fire extinguishers in the store are violating this code. I call a few attorney friends of mine and a few architects just to see if I'm interpreting this right, and they confirmed I was. And what I realized was I started trying to solve this cabinet problem. I inadvertently invented the only fire extinguisher that can be surface mounted and always comply with that rule, no matter what height it's mounted. And when I realized I solved that problem, that told me that the market was big enough to justify our existence. We just want, in 4 or 5 years, we want to be 0.25% of the market share on a per unit basis. You know, we want to get to 50,000 units a year. That gives us our estimated 0.25%. I've got some really smart people on our team that think we can be a 2% product. That would put us 10 times bigger than that. My gut tells me the truth somewhere in the middle. 2% is a lot. But do I think we can beat our 50,000 units? Absolutely. So I think, the truth somewhere in the middle. Even if we just sell 50,000 units, we're going to be happy, and we got a fantastic little business. But, yeah, maybe we're something a little bigger. There's international opportunities, too, because these accessibility codes that have been in our laws in the United States for 25 years. The rest of the world is just now bringing these type of codes into their building standards. It's an ISO standard. It's the international version of the ADA, basically. So a lot of the civilized, call them the first world countries, they're all implementing these codes right now, and they're kind of where the U.S. was back around 1990. Another 10, 15 years from now, a lot of Western European countries, Japan, Malaysia, Australia, you know, they're all going to be enforcing these codes, and we solve it there as well. So there's some international opportunity for us as we grow with our technology.
Well, Kevin, I certainly appreciate your sharing the full background on that, and really, really interesting, let me tell you. Now, also, I wanted to ask you if you could explain the importance, because I know that you went through this process, the importance of patenting your designs and how you protect them. I'm sure we can learn a lot from what you went through.
Sure. You know, this wasn't my first time going through the patent office either. So I learned a lot on my first patent back in the late 90s. I had invented a mobile computer lab in the late 90s, and it was basically a computer cart that you would put 32 laptops into, charge them all at once in one cart. It was motorized, because back then the laptops weighed a lot more than they weigh now. And so it had a little motor on it, so you could drive it around the school, but it would still fit through all your doorways. And we were doing wireless hotspots back in 1998. We called it a transceiver back then, because the Wi-Fi stuff wasn't commoditized yet. You couldn't buy a router at Best Buy like you can now. And so we patented our cart. We have a utility patent on it. But I learned an important lesson about utility patents back then, and it applies going forward to the rest of the story, is that, you know, we had the utility patent. We just get it awarded back around 2000, and there's a Super Bowl commercial, and there's Dell in their Super Bowl commercial where they've got their version of a cart that was just like ours. And they're trying to sell, wireless networking in schools for a mobile computer lab. The benefit was you don't have to take the real estate in a classroom and make that classroom a lab. You would take the lab to the kids. And so they've got their cart in their commercial, and right away I'm thinking, hey, they're violating my patent, which they were. And I call our patent attorney, and he taught me an important lesson. He said, yeah, they are. He says, but here's the problem. Now you have a patent, you have to enforce it. And here's what enforcement's going to look like. You're in Chicago, they're in Dallas or somewhere in Texas. He said, you're going to file a cease and desist. They're going to counterfile against your cease and desist in Dallas. So now you're going to be paying me to go to Dallas to the court system down there to defend your IP. When I say IP, it's intellectual property. And you're going to spend, he says, we'll win, but it's probably going to cost us about $500,000 to $1 million in legal fees. And he felt pretty confident that we would win, but he said, are you selling enough product to justify spending $500,000 to $1 million to defend it? And I said, no. And so what the value of that patent was really, it was very difficult for anybody to stop us. But at the same time, we weren't selling enough of them to try to stop anybody else from violating our patent. That's a real misconception. A lot of people think that, hey, you get a patent that nobody can copy or steal your ideas, whatever. They will and they can. It's just a matter of, is what you have great enough and valuable enough that it's worth defending it and fighting? So we learned the lesson the hard way that we didn't do anything. We didn't file any cease and desist letters in that because it would have opened a can of worms. Now, going forward, you know, we're looking at carrying on our patents that we've just been awarded in the last few months. We're looking at binding insurance, because you can buy patent insurance that you pay a little bit and you get, you know, the numbers are no secrets. You spend $40,000 a year and you can get about $2 million in attorney time. guaranteed to defend your patents for you. So it's not a bad trade-off to buy patent insurance. A lot of people aren't even aware you can buy patent insurance, but it's a great product. So the patent process, there's two types of patents. There's utility patents, and then there's design patents. And utility patents really have much more value overall than a design patent does. Some people, there's kind of a myth with patents that some people think that if you just make a little tweak on something that you can get around a patent. And that's not always the case. It's more the case for design patents that you can do that. So a good example of a design patent is, you know, maybe you have a purse and there's a distinctive look to the purse. Well, if somebody just changes a buckle, well, they can get around your design patent. And there's no violation there because they made it visibly different enough that you know it isn't the exact same product that was patented. With the utility patent, it's a little different. A utility patent is really on a brand new technology, a non-innovative concept, something that wasn't obvious to other people in the trade using the technology and the arts that exist at the time. That's what makes a utility patent so valuable, and they're also way harder to get. So we applied for a utility patent on our fire extinguishers, and we received the utility patent because there had never been, you know, non-round pressure vessels made for fire extinguishers. And we did some things that weren't obvious, and it's new technology. That's how we were able to get our patent. And there's a value in working with a good patent attorney because they know how to word things for you and do the drawings right and get everything coordinated. A lot of people think they can just do a patent themselves. And my best advice for anybody is hire a patent attorney. And there's guys and gals that'll work for less if you shop around, and there's some very good ones that don't cost near as much. But if you're going to go to a big firm right now to get a utility patent, you're going to spend minimum $20,000, and you could easily spend $50,000. Some smaller shops, you may be able to get it done for $10,000 and get it done well. But if, you know, before you go down the rabbit hole of deciding you're going to file a patent too, definitely do a search at the U.S. Patent Office's website. And you can search really well now yourself without having to have somebody else do it for you. If you go to the USPTO, U.S. Patent and Trade Office, to their website and search, and you want to be creative with your search terms, think of any other way somebody could describe your idea, because you may search with the words you're using that you've been using for your own invention, and you may not find anything out there. But, you know, maybe a good example, you could search for battery, but maybe you also need to search for power storage device. Think about, you know, other words, other descriptions for what you've done, and search every other which way you can with different words, and you'll find what I hate. It's a hard thing to tell some people, but most likely you'll be disappointed and find that it's already out there. You know, every couple weeks I get an idea that I think is great, and I'll go in, and the first thing I do is I go to the USPTO and I'll search, and almost always I'll find it's already out there. It's either been applied for and it's not awarded yet, because you can see the applications, or it's been awarded 5 or 10 years ago, or even sometimes 50 years ago. And so I learned that you can never think you're so smart that somebody else isn't thinking the same thing. Because there's over 6 billion people on the planet, and we're not all as unique as we think we are. And if we see a problem, chances are somebody else has seen that problem too. The game is really being the first. And it's not just the first to apply for a patent. There's a step before that. It's the first to execute, because a whole lot of people get ideas and just never execute. But, you know, it's it's definitely worth time to go straight to the patent office website. I wouldn't search on, you know, Google has a patent search page within Google. There's other sites. The U.S. Patent Office sites is the best place to search of any place. And but, you know, be prepared to be disappointed. And, you know, feel, you know, it's a kind of a pinprick in your personal bubble because you're excited. You get an idea and you feel great about it and you don't believe that it's out there. And usually you'll find it is. So, but before, you know, the thing is, you can also save yourself a lot of money because there's a lot of people that are happy to take your money and search for you. But in this day and age, with the Patent Office website, you can do pretty good searches ahead of time for yourself before you decide to spend any money. So I totally recommend self-search.
Some really good information right there on patenting our designs and how to protect them. Really appreciate that. I also wanted to hear, if in conclusion, your top three challenges associated with raising capital.
It's a great question. You know, I didn't start out with a great network. Some people have a lot better networks. The thing is, the challenges is you have to determine how much you need. So first you need to create a good business plan, and you've probably heard that before from many other people, and it's totally true. And a great tool for building a business plan is, I'm going to give them a free plug, but I love their product. It's called LivePlan. It's liveplan.com. It's really great because it walks you through a lot of questions and steps, and you can write a business plan that's 10 pages or you can write one that's 200 pages. And it has lots of great spreadsheets and templates that all talk to each other, from the price of the product. If you change the price of the product, it'll affect the cash flow 5 years from now. It's really an amazing product and incredibly inexpensive. So Live Plan for business plan. Invest the time in the business plan, even if it takes you 80 to 100 hours, invest the time, because you will see things developing it that you didn't think of that you need to accommodate for. And then it'll get you ready to be smart enough to know how much money you need. And my suggestion is take whatever you see and double it. And that's really what you need. Now, you know how much you need. And then you're ready to approach whether it's friends and family first, whether it's other people in the industry that may be interested in investing in the business, whether it's the SBA office or a branch of a local bank that works with the SBA, depending on the business you're doing, you know, it may be something that you can generate revenue very soon and early. And those are always easier businesses to raise money under. If it's something like starting a fire extinguisher company, it's not easy because, you know, we're pre-revenue for 3 years. And so the challenge is finding people that are willing to invest, not just in your product, but invest in you. And finding a valuation is tough. There's some good metrics that, you know, once you get your business plan crafted, you kind of look at, you know, investors and something like that are very often are thinking about the exit. So you need to think about, you know, what's this company potentially worth if it were to be bought 3 or 5 years from now? And you can use numbers like that to help back into your valuation. You know, are you saying that, because eventually you have to ask, how much equity am I willing to exchange for the money from the investor, and what's fair? And don't get greedy. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth, because it's hard. It's hard to find that money. And if it's there and it's available, and if you're deciding, am I going to, you know, give away another 10%? Well, give away the 10% to get the cash in hand, get the business going. And if you're successful, you're just going to be that much bigger, and that 10% is irrelevant. But it's not easy. And but also respect, you know, your investors, potential investors, because they're going to be your shareholders. They're part of the team. You have a responsibility to them now. It's not just about what you want once you start raising capital. it's what all, what's in the best interest of the shareholders, and you need to keep that in mind too.
Well, Kevin, we certainly appreciate all the information shared here, so much that we can take away and learn here. And again, thanks for your time and all the solid information shared here on the program. Where can listeners get more information? Well, first of all, where can they purchase Oval brand fire products, and where can we get more details online?
Well, to purchase our extinguishers, you can go on our website. There's a find a distributor page, and we have distributors, fire equipment distributors around the country. We're also, we have our products on Amazon, so you can find them there as well. And, you know, if you want to visit our website, it's www.ovalfireproducts.com.
Once again, Mr. Kozlowski, we thank you for your time and for joining us here today on Enterprise Radio, and continued success to you and the company.
Thank you. Thanks, Eric.
You bet. We have been speaking with Mr. Kevin Kozlowski, President and CEO of Oval Brand Fire Products. And for more information, visit ovalfireproducts.com. And this is Eric Dye, and you've been listening to Enterprise Radio, a part of EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Pick up our iPhone or Android mobile app for your exclusive mobile listening convenience. And once again, we do thank you for tuning in.
Thanks again for listening to Enterprise Radio here on the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. To subscribe for future programming, simply visit epodcastnetwork.com.
This is the ePodcast Network.